Welcome. We are hearing our second case today. It's Wadey versus LeMethieu, and it's 21 AP 802. Appearances, please. All right. Excellent. Nice to see you all this morning. 25 minutes to start, followed by 30 and 5 in rebuttal, right? Great. Thanks. Please proceed.
Thank you so much, Your Honor. Let me just begin by saying it's really a pleasure to be here in person with you all again. The circuit court's decision here is an unprecedented intrusion into the legislature's basic functioning, disabling the legislature from obtaining expert advice, needed expert advice, during a critical period of the decennial redistricting process. And the circuit court did this based upon a sua sponte interpretation of 1674 that my friends did not urge upon the circuit court and that my friends don't even defend before this court. Now, the most straightforward way to dispose of this case is to conclude that the two contracts at issue here are contracts for services, professional services, that are required within the legislative branch. These are clearly contracts, they're clearly for services, and they are required within the legislative branch because the legislative branch, consistent with decades of uniform bipartisan practice, needs the advice, as determinant needs the advice, of expert counsel in this very difficult area of law. Now, the circuit court's decision here was to conclude that the legislature, and by extension the courts and the administrative agencies, have no authority ever to enter into services contracts, except when those contracts are tied to supplies, material, personal property, and things of that sort. As this court explained at the stay stage, that would essentially insert the word accompanying before the word services, and therefore it has no textual basis. Now, normally I would spend more time on the merits of the underlying decisions on appeal, but I think my friends see that position is textually unsustainable, and they did not defend it in their briefs. So then I will now turn to the argument that my friends did make. And so what they do is they go even beyond what the circuit court did. And they say that 1674, and by extension 1671, does not give the legislature, the courts, or the administrative agencies any authority whatsoever to enter into contracts, whether it's for services or supplies to buy pens and paper and computers, that authority must be found somewhere else in statutory law.
So, counsel, if we accept your argument under 16.74, it still requires that they be purchased by the Joint Committee on Legislative Organization or by the House or legislative service agency that is utilizing these services. Did that happen here?
The statute also allows purchase by authorized agents. And the way that the legislature and its internal...
You're talking about who signs it, the second piece of that? I'm not talking about who signs it. I'm talking about the authorization part, which under sub 1 says it shall be, so pretty clear on that, purchased by, and then it says the Joint Committee on Legislative Organization. Did it go through the Joint Committee or by the House?
It went through the House, and the House designated... The House obviously does not... It's just a body. It can't itself sign the piece of paper. It was signed by the House's designated agents, which were the leaders of the Assembly and the Senate.
Do you want us to read sub B, who signs it, to be really who, to really be in place of sub 1 in terms of the actual authorization? So whoever signs it authorizes it?
If the House has authorized somebody to sign it.
Stop. When did the House authorize someone to sign it? And when did the Senate authorize? I think there was actually some testimony that was in March about the House.
So the authorizations were first given in 2017. That's found at Appendix 126 through 130.
How was that done? That was voted on by the House?
It was And then there was additional authorizations given in 2021. The way it was done is the way that it's always been done by the legislature, is the authorization by the Assembly Committee on Organization and the Senate Committee on Organization
by
a majority vote.
Even though that's not listed here as one of the committees, it's the Joint Committee on Organization pursuant to the statute, correct?
Well, that's if it was a joint purchase. The way that the individual houses work, which is the also or by the House, is that the houses do it through their organization committees, because obviously the houses are not going to have a full floor vote every single time that they want to authorize purchases. They've delegated that authority to their organization committees. And that's,
do you want us to read the words in sub 1, House Committee on Legislative Organization, where it says by the House?
I would not say read it in. I would say the House determines how it operates on its own. That's core to its functions under Ozan and Stitt and cases of that sort. So each House determines how it's going to act. And here the House, for decades and decades, has decided, the Assembly has and the Senate has said it acts in this area through the votes and actually the signature votes of the respective organizing committees of the Assembly and the Senate.
Mr. Saitlin, weren't the contracts with these two law firms signed before the vote in the Senate committee and the Committee on Assembly Organization?
I have a couple of answers to that, Your Honor. Just let me walk through it.
Please.
There were authorizations for leaders to obtain services for redistricting signed in 2017 that had not expired. Those were still operative when the initial contracts were signed. Then the contracts were signed, and the Senate and the Assembly then had other ballots. Now, the operative contract with regard to Constable McCarthy and Mortaro, there's been a superseding one that was signed in late March. All of the authorizations, there was both sets of authorizations by the time that was signed. It's a little more complicated with regard to the St. John contract, but I think for purposes of this court, what matters is there were the authorizations of 2017, and then the authorizations later given are either redundant of that, or under basic contractual principles, they authorized what the leaders did.
And you did explain this a little better to me then. I don't understand, if there was already authorization, why then did the Senate committee need to vote on January 5th or the Committee on Assembly Organization vote on March 24th if they already had authorization?
Your Honor, I would say that's in the nature of belt and suspenders. You had an authorization, and they decided they wanted to make clear that if anyone disputed that 2017 authorization was problematic in any way, they made clear that they had no problem with these contracts, that the leaders, when they entered these contracts, did in fact speak for the legislature.
Okay, so let's talk about belt and suspenders. Part of what the 1674 talks about is what happens with the people's money in this state, right? And it goes through the Department of Administration. And I'm looking at sub 4, which says that that statements for purchases and engagements made by the officer under this section, I'm sorry, let me start at the beginning of the sentence. I'm looking at sub 4. Each legislative and judicial officer shall file all bills and statements for purchases and engagements made by the officer under this section with the secretary, and here they're talking about the secretary of administration, of course, who shall audit and authorize payments of all lawful bills and statements. Was there ever an audit or the authorization of payments by the DOA secretary here?
Let me break down your question into a couple of subsidiary parts. First, with regard to what the legislature did here in submitting its payment. It went through PeopleSoft. It's a software program that some of the justices on this court may be familiar with the submission of bills and other things. And I would ask your honors to take a look at Appendix 384 through 386, where the Senate business manager, 15 years experience, explains that this PeopleSoft process that the legislature used to submit the bills for payment to DOA here is exactly what's been used in every contract that the legislature has done for the last, I think, 12 years that she it was either 12 or 15 years that she testified to there, and both for attorney contracts and every other contract. And that is, you know, we're at the summary judgment stage. That is the only evidence in the record on that. So that's with regard to what the legislature did. Now, there's also a claim that the DOA did not do some manner of additional auditing. With respect, if they're concerned that the DOA didn't audit with sufficient vigor, that kind of lawsuit should be brought against the DOA, and the relief shouldn't be to void these contracts as a void ab initio. The relief would be to say whatever they think DOA needs to do more of in terms of auditing, make DOA do that additional auditing. The legislature can't control how much audit the DOA has. My friends have not sued the DOA to have a count in their claim that said, DOA, you should have done more audit. So that's the kind of the two pieces, which is that the legislature did everything right, consistent with uniform practice. The DOA is not here, and we don't have record evidence about, you know, what they did or didn't do, and if they did something that was insufficient vigor, the lawsuit should be against DOA.
I think their argument is, and your friend on the other side, Mr. Pines, maybe will make this when he stands up, but I think the argument is, and I've used PeopleSoft, right?
So, but
PeopleSoft, using PeopleSoft, asking for reimbursement in PeopleSoft is different than an audit or the authorization of the payment, right?
Well, Your Honor, so with regards to authorization of the payment, as far as the record doesn't reflect this, but you know, I assume the payments were made. So in terms of the amount of auditing, that is not an obligation on the legislature. That is an obligation on the Department of Administration. The Department of Administration is not here. And again, if the Department of Administration did not do sufficient auditing, the remedy is to require the Department of Administration to do more auditing. It's not to void the underlying contracts by the entity that did nothing wrong, which is the legislature.
Counsel, you're not asking us to really find under 16.74, though, correct? You're really asking us to find that there was authorization or ability to make these hires under 13.124, right?
Your Honor, our primary submission is 1674. That is our primary submission. We have an argument under 13.124. I will be glad.
Here's my question on 13.124. What's the limitation? If you want us to read 13.124 to authorize the obtaining of legal counsel before there's an actual action, even though the language says in any action in which the Assembly is a party, just using sub B as an example, what is the limitation? Because the way I see you arguing it in your brief is that the Speaker of the Assembly in his or her sole discretion could therefore obtain legal counsel anytime they believe that there could possibly be an action on anything, any subject, and bind the taxpayer to be paying for that. The limitation?
We are, just to be clear, our primary position is 1674. We agree that the argument on 13.124 is a much closer argument, and there are certainly credible arguments raised by the other side. Our position is that if a lawsuit is imminent, and imminence can be judged by a court, then this authorization could. Let me give you an example.
No, and I know what you're saying,
yeah.
And it makes sense that makes perfect sense to me, right?
Yes.
The problem I'm having is it's the legislature coming to us, asking us to read a statute the legislature passed, where the legislature could have put language in that said something like imminent action. Instead, the legislature chose the language in any action. And therefore, when we're bound to read the words as they are passed, the legislature passed this is what the intent is gleaned from the words. So how do I get imminent out of action? And what does imminent mean, and who would possibly define that?
Your Honor, our statutory argument is reading the words is and are through the prism of 990.001.
Right, and I get that, and that gets to who's the party, but there still has to be an action. So I'll give you that they're not a party yet, that reads in the future, but how do you read action in that way?
I believe, Your Honor, that if and I hope this doesn't happen, someone sends me a demand letter tomorrow, says, I'm going to sue you next week for $1 million. Hope this doesn't happen. I would say, with coherent English that I think most people understand, is that I will be a party in an action because I have been told that there will be an action next week, and I will be a party in that action. That action does not yet exist. That is true in my hypothetical. But I think the most common understanding of English... No, if I called my mom afterwards and I said, Mom, I got this letter. I'm going to be sued for $1 million next week. I will be a party in an action. She wouldn't be like, there's no current action. Like, that would not be how the language would be used. So I agree, Your Honor, that is a more difficult question than 1674, but I do believe that it is consistent with common English usage.
Are you aware of any case in which this court defines action to be something that's not currently a legal proceeding?
I am not saying. I'm saying that when one uses, and assuming Your Honors agree with me, that is and are can be read as will be, that when one says, I will be a party in an action, that, as a matter of common English, can mean an action that is reasonably anticipated. Now, I think there is a credible argument the other way, and I'm not going to stand up here and say that there are not fair arguments on 13.124 either way. We think we have the better of the argument, but there are credible arguments the other way. But with respect, I just don't think there is a credible argument that the contracts here do not fall into 1674, which is why we made that our lead argument, and we focused on that primarily in our briefing, and that's, you know, the lion's share of the briefing we submitted to the court.
Well, counsel, certainly there is an action pending at this moment.
There is an action. There's multiple actions pending, Your Honor. I believe three of them, two in federal court, and one here, or more than one, depending on Your Honor wants to consider interveners and things of that sort. And that's, of course, we knew that was going to happen. It happens every decennial. Everyone is, you know, there's always a lawsuit over redistricting. This is like clockwork, at least since Reynolds v. Sims in the 1960s. Every single map is challenged on this theory or that theory. So certainly everyone understood that there was going to be a lawsuit. And that's why the legislature signed these contracts, consistent with the practice that's been going on in the states and the states all over the country since Reynolds v. Sims.
Mr. Salen, so what I'm hearing you say is that your best argument is under 1674.
I think we have very strong arguments in 1674, and under those clause of the Constitution, we present backup arguments on the other two provisions, but those are our lead arguments.
Okay, so let's return back to 1674. I have two questions for you.
Yes,
my first question is, I want to understand a little bit more about the contracts, and do the contracts with each firm include drawing maps? That's my first question. My second question is, their contractual services to whom? That is, are the contractual services just to Speaker Voss and just to Majority Leader Lemieux? Are they to just the Republicans in each the Assembly or the Senate? Or are they to all the members of the legislature?
Let me answer the first question first. And so the St. John contract includes legal advice relating to constitutional statutory requirements of maps, but not the map drawing itself. So presumably somebody else would draw a map for the legislature, a proposed map, or multiple maps. You know, they're submitted through the legislature's website. And then, you know, Kevin St. John and his law firm would then provide legal advice on the constitutional and statutory requirements attended to those maps, which somebody else draws. With regard to the Consovoy-Mataro contract, what they provide is pre-litigation consulting. That is, you know, the census is delayed. What does that mean about the timing of when we might be subject to a lawsuit? What does that mean about when we should schedule our hearings to best coordinate with not being sued at a time we don't want? So those are the two contracts do that. Neither of them have map drawing itself, but they do have those kind of functions. Now, with regard to your second question, the services are contracted to provide it for the legislature, not for legislators individually. Now, it is obviously unfortunate in today's world that a lot of times there's a lot of partisanship, and maybe the party in the majority isn't, as a practical matter, you know, in this, you know, working as closely as we, you know, as one could with a party minority. But in actuality, the services are provided to the entire legislature. The legislature is doing the map drawing, it's doing the adopting, and anybody could be involved in that.
I got to push back on that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it in the record at all that either of the law firms did give advice to the minority in the legislature, the minority party in the legislature?
I don't believe there's any evidence in the record that kind of interaction occurred. The only thing about this was an amicus brief that was submitted without proper affidavit. So I don't think there's any actual record evidence here about that. But look, if you look at the record evidence we did put in about what happened in prior years, is that the majority party would contract with counsel for the legislature. The minority party would often be unhappy with what they're doing, and then they would outside of that process contract with private counsel. That evidence is in the record as a practical matter. But the contracts themselves are for the legislature. That is the way that they function. And if the minority party is unhappy with the counsel that was chosen by the majority, they, of course, can use the private funds to obtain counsel if they wish.
Counsel, I have a few questions. On the 16.74 argument, how much is the process of whether those have been approved or paid for before us in your mind? In other words, I'm curious how much some of that back and forth matters for the purposes of your argument. Do we need to hold that the 2017 authorizations were sufficient in order for you to prevail or not?
So if one looks at the complaint, which is obviously the operative document here, none of those issues were raised. So this court need not address that. No, but in fairness to my friends, they did raise that, these kinds of issues, in opposition to our motion to dismiss, which was then converted for a motion for summary judgment. So while your honors could rule for us just on the four corners of the specific legal issue, I think it is also fair for this court to opine on those broader issues if this court so chooses.
Thanks. On the Chapter 13 argument, and maybe this applies to Chapter 16 too. If the legislature commences a lawsuit, under where does it derive its authority? Is it one of those two?
In order to obtain counsel, Your Honor, it could certainly contract under 1674. The leaders could also go under 13.124. Either one. Mm-hmm. Now, as a practical matter, as a historical practice, and when the legislature usually has time to consider whether it's going to go into a lawsuit, so it does go through the joint or the organization process through the balloting under 1674. But you could imagine a circumstance where the legislature needs to file a lawsuit in an emergency context. This is the kind of thing that happened about a year and a half ago when the governor attempted to move the Supreme Court election. And then there might not be enough time to go through the joint committee process. But as a historical matter, 1674 is what the legislature uses, because when you bring a lawsuit, almost all the time, there's time. You got to think about it. You got to put together the original action or the complaint and things of that sort. So you wouldn't need to go through the expedited procedure.
Okay. Thanks.
So
of questions that are of concern to me. In looking at the statute, 1674, that comes under the area of DOA, the Department of Administration. And it seems as though that deals with, that whole chapter area, deals with the manner of procurement and reimbursement. And it just seems odd to me that statute would be interpreted to give authority to the legislature to hire counsel. I mean, that's quite enough. It doesn't speak of authority of the legislature. It speaks of rather the mundane. How do you procure? How do you get reimbursed? Can you address my concern regarding your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. So 1670, 71, 74. Those are the procurement. Those are the purchasing statutes for the state. When this court makes purchases of pens and computers and things of that sort, it goes through 1674, just like the legislature does. There's, as far as I know, there's no independent authorization for this court or the legislature to purchase computers, pens, papers, or things of that sort. It is through 1674 that those purchases are made. And I think it's telling that when we called my friends to this, says, well, how can any of the branches of government function under your interpretation? They pointed to a statute that allows the purchase of flowers for ill or deceased legislators, $300 for election challenges, and some witness fees. So under that interpretation, Your Honor, not only is it not grounded in the text, it would hobble the operation of all three branches of the state's government. But I do see my time is running out, and I did really want, unless Your Honor has a follow-up, to talk about our last issue, because we do think it's critically important. We would respectfully request that this court issue a published decision and provide guidance to lower courts and to litigants about what to do in situations where there is a stay pending appeal being sought. What happened here, I would respectfully submit, should not happen again, is that the circuit court issued a decision on 1674 on a ground that no one had argued. Then we sought a stay, and the circuit court tells us, well, my decision is not going to be stayed for the reasons I already said. Then we move for a stay immediately. Circuit court denies it. We then appeal to the Court of Appeals. And we're waiting week after week after week after week for a decision. It took more than two months for us to get a decision stay. In that time period, we suffered weeks and weeks of irreparable harm under a decision that should have been stayed from the outset. This same kind of thing happened in SEIU and League of Women Voters, and I would respectfully submit that this is not a sustainable situation. Now, I see my time is up, and I'd like to be able to discuss this a little bit more in my rebuttal, but I would ask this court to please publish a decision with regard to the stay issue, because guidance is desperately needed by lower courts and by the bar.
Thank you. Thanks, counsel.
Chief Justice Ziegler, members of the court, may it please the court. I represent the plaintiff's respondents who are taxpayers. And this lawsuit was about the violation of the statutes which allow the spending of money by the legislature. I want to make reference to Genesis chapter 3, verses 9 through 13. That's the story of when God confronts Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And God says to Adam, did you eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge? And Adam says, she made me do it. And then God says to Eve, did you eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge? And she says, the serpent made me do it. So from the first human beings who had consciousness of right from wrong, good and evil, life and death, who had one law that they had to follow, which was, don't eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge, and they would not take responsibility for their behavior. So for millennia, we have people, and that's probably the greatest problem that we face as lawyers and judges, that people, legislators, citizens, won't take responsibility for their own behavior.
Counsel,
Speaker and the majority, excuse me.
Let's dive into the statute if we could.
The story was so good, Justice Hagedorn.
Would you like to talk about Exodus 2?
Let's roll.
The Ten Commandments?
Lamentations would be a better one.
Counsel, under your theory of Chapter 16, how is it that the legislature can purchase for itself paper clips and power cords?
They can do that.
Point to me then the statute that gives them that authorization.
The statute that gives them that authorization is the statute that governs their self-sufficient budget. And that's that statute allows them to purchase. There is appropriated to the legislature for the following programs. This is 20.765 legislature. There is appropriated to the legislature for the following programs, enactment of state laws. Enactment of state laws. General program operations, a sum sufficient budget to carry out the functions of the assembly, excluding expenses for legislative documents, the same for the Senate. That's for enactment of state laws, for the functions of the assembly and the Senate. So there's no question they have the authority to spend that money to function in their actual constitutionally required activity, which is to legislate.
Does obtaining legal counsel, would obtaining legal counsel ever be a function of enacting laws?
It very well could be. It very well could be. However, in 2018, after Governor Evers' election and after the election of the Attorney General Call, who were both Democrats, for the first time then in approximately 9 years, the Republican-controlled legislature was faced with the problem of having a Democratic Attorney General. On November 30th of 2018, the legislature passed three separate laws to ensure that they could have counsel outside of the Attorney General. Up until then, the legislature, if it wanted to get have an attorney to represent it in a lawsuit, the attorney would be from the Department of Justice. The Assembly passed three laws, 13.165, that allowed the Joint Committee on Legislative or Senate Organization to intervene in actions in which the constitutionality of statutes, federal preemption, the challenge to the construction or validity of a statute could be done. An action has to exist in order for an intervention to take place. That's one statute.
Yeah. Let me just ask a quick follow-up to that. So, and I ask this to your opposing counsel about commencement of lawsuits.
Right.
Under what theory of your reading of any of these statutes could the legislature ever commence a lawsuit?
The legislature can commence a lawsuit by under the statutes which govern the powers of the Attorney General, 165.25.1M.
What if the legislature is opposed to the Attorney General?
The legislature is opposed to the Attorney General?
Mm-hmm.
The legislature could ask the governor to appoint separate counsel for it.
And if the governor will not?
Then the legislature cannot, under any statute, institute legislation on its own. And I want to point out here that these contracts were not entered into on behalf of the legislature. These contracts were entered into on behalf of the Assembly and the Senate. The legislature did not hire these lawyers, despite the fact that that the two legislators have come into this court and characterized themselves as the legislature. They are not.
So your position is absent working through the Attorney General or appointment by the governor, that the legislature would have no independent ability to commence litigation?
Well, under the Koschke case, the legislature could also ask the court to allow them to proceed with outside counsel.
Just like the court granted the governor the right to his own counsel when his party was not the same as
That's
the
correct.
Attorney General's party.
That's correct. So, so to the extent I...
So the legislature would petition the court to allow counsel in the piece of litigation of their own choosing?
They could, even if because there's no statutory language anywhere existing, zero, that allows the legislature to commence an action on its own. Now, perhaps if they do, as they did in the legislature versus Palm and legislature versus Evers, the issue was not fully litigated there. The court allowed the legislature to proceed. So that's possible. But if you look at what the legislature did in 2018, The legislation was proposed on November 30th, enacted on December 14th, became law on December 15th. They did three things. They allowed for intervention in these limited circumstances that I described. They allowed the Joint Committee on Legislative Organization under 165.25.1M to intervene in any case in which the Attorney General represents the state. And 13.124. This lawsuit was not brought about 16.74. This lawsuit was brought about a violation of 13.124. And 13.124 is a statute that needs to be read. Now, the court here is doing a de novo review. The court is, you are sitting as if you were the circuit court judge and starting from scratch, except you're bound by the record in this case. The record in the case shows that the speaker and the soon-to-be majority leader of the Senate in December of 2020 entered into a contract with the Consovoy Law Firm. And the Consovoy Law Firm was hired to represent the legislature in a redistricting case, maybe. Because what the Consovoy contract says, this is what is in the record. What it said is the Consovoy McCarthy firm will represent the Assembly and the Senate in possible litigation related to decennial redistricting. Possible litigation. The parties currently do not know whether or in what venue the litigation will occur. The Bell Giftos contract says Bell Giftos St. John agrees to provide legal advice to, represent, and appear for, and defend the Wisconsin State Senate and Wisconsin State Assembly. Now, the rule of statutory interpretation really goes back to what Justice Felix Frankfurter said. There are really three rules, according to Justice Frankfurter. Also, Willard Hurst, famous professor at the University of Wisconsin. Three rules. Read the statute. And then this court, on its own, in 1895, has said, statutory interpretation begins with the language of the statute. If the meaning of the statute is plain, we ordinarily stop the inquiry. In construing or interpreting a statute, the court is not at liberty to disregard the plain, clear words of the statute. When you look at 13.124, and remember, 13.124 is a new statute. And as Justice Scalia wrote in his seminal book with Brian Garner, the specific governs over the general. It's at page 183, section 28. He says, the specific provision does not negate the general one entirely, but only in its application to the situation that the specific provision covers. So in 2018, when these statutes were enacted, they are the specific statute about precisely what they discuss. And what they discuss is the hiring of outside counsel. 13.124 is entitled Legal Representation. Legal Representation. And it has two parts to it. In each section, 1A and 1B, 2A and 2B, 3A and 3B. In the A section of those statutes, that talks about the representation of an employee. And it talks about that by saying that when there's a representation of an employee, you You can go to outside counsel other than the Department of Justice. If the elements of the claim against that employee fall within the scope of their employment, in an action in which.
It doesn't say present action, though, does it?
Well,
we have
no. Let me, Chief Justice, if I could.
Counsel, sure. Why don't we just advise counsel to? Well, we don't give this kind of advice, perhaps. But why don't we just note that they could simply re-sign these contracts? There are two actions pending: one in federal court and one before this.
Not involving the Assembly or the Senate.
There are two actions pending that involve redistricting.
That's correct, but not as. Neither the Assembly nor the Senate are parties to those actions.
And you think that's critical?
Well, these lawyers were hired to represent the Assembly and the Senate. They were not hired to represent the legislature because 13.124 specifically says in sub 3A and B that the only entity that has the authority to hire outside counsel other than the Department of Justice is the Joint Committee on Legislative Organization. Right. The Joint Committee on Legislative Organization did not enter into these contracts. So the legislature is not represented by these.
Well,
by these.
Trying to say that the Assembly as a whole can't do what was done here, that it must be done by an Assembly committee. But if the Assembly or the Senate as a whole does it, I don't see how it doesn't include the actions of the committee that you're concerned about.
No, the committee did not act.
No, you didn't understand what I just said to you.
Okay.
What I said was, if the Assembly and then the Senate authorize this, why shouldn't we conclude that the action of a body of our legislature includes the action of the committee that the statute references?
If I understand what you're saying that the committee authorized Devin LeMahieu and Robin Voss to enter into these contracts.
Okay. What I'm saying
now, the Consovoy contract was entered into in December of 2018, and Robin LeMahieu did not become the majority leader until the next session, which started in January, but he signed the contract in December. That's what the record shows.
Well, that's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine. We affirm contracts all the time that have been signed earlier than the work that's going to be done on them. I mean, it happens regularly in contract law.
Right,
you're aware of that. That's not my concern.
But
my concern is I was trying to address your argument that it had to, these lawsuits had to be addressed by the Joint Committee on Legislative Organization under 3A and
no,
that's what I was.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood you.
Right.
The Assembly, the legislature, the statute requires for the representative of the legislature, not the Assembly, not the Senate, those are covered by 1 and 2 respectively. 3 says that the co-chairpersons of the Joint Committee on Legislative Organization, in their sole discretion, may obtain legal counsel other than from the Department of Justice. As determined by the co-chairpersons in any action in which the legislature is a party. The legislature. So this case was about contracts for representation of the Assembly and for representation of the Senate. The contracts are not for representation of the legislature per se.
Well, the legislature has two parts, doesn't it?
Well, yes, it does. But the legislature said that when you are operating under 13.124, you split them up. So the Speaker can get outside counsel for the Assembly. But because really what's very important, Justice Rogenczyk, is you have to look at the whole statute.
I have read it.
And the whole statute says, the whole statute, A, 1A, 1B, 1A, 2A, and 3A, talk about representation of the employees of the Senate, the Assembly, the Senate, And then 3A talks about employees of the legislative service agencies. And all of those A's have to do with actions that exist. And the language...
That's your interpretation. I don't think that it says...
Well, it has to. It's not my interpretation.
It's been repeated that the legislature has lawyered itself up when it's got the obligation to redistrict. It's happened whether you had a Democratic legislature, Republican legislature. This is what they've done because they think it's a complicated issue and they want to do it right. So
right.
They want to have legal advice.
Well, the record does not reflect, Your Honor, that the legislature did, quote, lawyer up, close quote, in advance of the filing of an action. That is not in this record. That's what's here. We're on a record because you're hearing a motion for summary judgment. We're not here on a theoretical question about what can the legislature do and what can the legislature not do.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is this. In the A's of section 13.124, it talks about an action, and it talks about where the people are alleged to have acted within the scope of their employment. It had to be an action that exists, because if the action doesn't exist, you can't know if there is an allegation of whether or not they're acting within the scope of their employment. Likewise, and under the B's of section 13.124, the speaker or the majority leader can't know whether the assembly's interests or the Senate's interests are affected until they know what the lawsuit is about.
Well, they know it's going to be about redistricting. That wouldn't take a crystal ball to figure out.
Well, that may very well be true, Justice Robesack, but they wrote the statute. They wrote the statute. And they've written other statutes. For example, in the open meetings law at 19.85, they talk about, that statute talks about imminent litigation or legislation that might happen. The legislature knows how to write that if they want to.
Does that and the statute you just reference say imminent litigation?
It doesn't use the word imminent. Give you the exact...
Well, if it says imminent, of course, the one you're arguing to us does not say.
No. Can you give me the exact language?
Doesn't qualify it at all.
Yeah. What I want... You need to... You need to ask yourself, Justice Robesack, why would the legislature have passed these laws?
No, I don't.
And why
do... No, I don't. What I need to do is read the words they actually passed and do my very best to interpret their plain meaning.
That's right.
Unless they're otherwise defined.
That's right. And in any action in which the assembly is a party, in any action in which the assembly is a party.
Or in which the interests of the assembly are affected.
That's right. Or in which the interests of the assembly are affected. How do you know, how can anyone know whether or not there's going to be interest affected if the action does not exist?
Well, counsel, I mean, I hear your point, but, all right. I'm unaware of any legislative redistricting since the 1960s that has not been challenged in court. If there is a more certain litigation that exists, I'm unaware of it. It's about as guaranteed as, well, you can fill in the blank.
Yeah.
So litigation for sure was going to happen here one way or the other, regardless of any political process that played out. And I think it's pretty well established the interests of the legislature are affected by redistricting one way or the other as well. We more or less held as much when we allowed intervention in the suit before this court that's currently pending.
Right.
So I have a difficult time at least conceiving of how it's not a given that this action was going to happen. Your statutory argument, I understand what it is, and it's different. But I have a difficult time at least accepting the proposition that the interests of the Assembly and or Senate are not in play and that we didn't know this litigation was going to happen.
Well, that's reading a lot more into the statute that's in the statute. Because the statute reads whether they're a part, if they, the statute says, in any action in which the assembly is a party,
or in which the interests don't need to be a party.
Yeah, the action has to be where there is the legislature is a party, and the action has to affect the assembly's interest. It can't be that the speaker has the sole discretion to hire outside counsel in a theoretical lawsuit that might exist where the interests of the assembly are affected. Because if you do that, if that's how you interpret the statute, and this is the real danger in this case, the speaker and the majority leader can imagine today, well, there's going to be open records lawsuits brought against us. There's going to be lawsuits brought against us about different statutes. There's going to be federal lawsuits about this or that that we think we might have an interest in. And we can go to the taxpayers' money and we can hire attorneys, outside counsel. We don't have to use the Department of Justice, which is budgeted. We can go and hire outside counsel and pay them any amount of money we want to pay them for any amount of time we want to pay them. And they don't have to do anything. That's what the Consovoy contract said, the initial contract and the revised contract. The revised contract, by the way, only changed the amounts of money that was being paid. The Consovoy contract is $30,000 a month to do nothing, to stand by.
Do you really, truly think the legislature is so cavalier with the people's money? Do you honestly believe that?
Absolute power corrupts. Yeah. Absolute power corrupts.
Mr. Pines, I'm going
to... They're willing to pay $30,000 a month to a lawyer to sit by and wait. They've been sued in numerous open records cases. Maybe they'll pay a lawyer $30,000 a month to sit by, or maybe they want to have a shadow attorney general's office. They don't like the attorney general now. Let's have all of these outside counsel standing by in cases where we might have an interest in an action that might be filed. Because when you interpret the statute based on the idea that, well, everybody knows redistricting is going to be litigated, then you say, then where's the stopping point?
Well, I think counsel, we
maybe the
it
stopping
one by one, counsel.
Maybe the stopping point is this. I look at Article 4, Section 3, which of the Constitution, which deals with apportionment. And of course, the legislature has the duty to apportion. We've said in cases, including the Jensen case, that
correct.
Apportionment
yes.
is quintessential, right?
Yes.
So let's take 13.124 off the radar screen, because the preoccupation is on the word action. Under Article 4, Section 3, if the words of this contract did not deal with litigation, but instead there was a new contract that read, to assist in apportionment, would you be here?
No. Because the legislature, well after 16.74 was enacted, that goes back decades in various forms. In 2018, the legislature gave itself a specific power. That specific power was to go to outside counsel other than the Department of Justice. They can still go to the Department of Justice and request that they represent them, but they didn't want to do that. They said in any action in which the legislature is a party or in which it has an interest. In which it has an interest refers back to the word action. And an action doesn't exist until a summons and complaint are filed.
Mr. Pines, I want to ask you to pivot a little bit to 1674 and your friend on the other side. I'm adopting that, Mr. Saitlin. Your friend on the other side, Mr. Saitlin, says on page 22 of the blue brief that you do not explain how DOA's obligation to audit could impact the legislature's statutory authority to procure legal services under 16.74. So I want to give you the opportunity now to explain that. I asked Mr. Saitlin those questions too, questions related to that a few minutes ago.
The point is, 16.74 requires invoices to be submitted to the Secretary of the Department of Administration for audit and payment. If you're going to hire outside counsel, you want to have an attorney-client relationship with that outside counsel, which is confidential. But if the billings that are submitted by that counsel are subjected to audit by a third party, and if the work of expert witnesses who might be hired by that outside counsel are part of that billing, that work is subject to audit by the Secretary of the Department of Administration. One of the things, so the legislature can go ahead and hire outside counsel for some purposes, but if they hire outside counsel for litigation, every single bill from that attorney, every single bill from expert witnesses has got to be sent to the Secretary of the Department of Administration for audit, and there's no attorney-client privilege. And the reason that the contracts are audited is because somebody has to be looking over the shoulder of people who are spending the taxpayers' money. 13.124 allows the speaker and the majority leader on their own to hire people, get the bills, approve the payment of the bills, and there's nobody else looking over their shoulder. That's part of the reason why that statute is so dangerous and why it is used in limited circumstances. And those limited circumstances are when the legislature is a party. Look at the contract, the Bell-Giftos contract. It talks about representing the Assembly and Senate to defend it. They understood what that meant. This isn't just a, you know, so the answer, Justice Karofsky, is 13.74 existed, but they didn't follow 13.74. They didn't submit the bills for audit to the Department of Administration.
16.74, correct?
16.74. They didn't submit the bills for audit to the Secretary. The only thing in the record is the Docket 37, Exhibit B, a letter from Ann Hansen. What does she say? DOA has received payment requests from the legislature for payments to be issued to the law firms named above. When these requests were submitted to DOA for issuance of payments following the required internal approvals within the legislature, no invoices or other bills or statements were included for DOA to review and audit. Now, that piece, that undisputed piece of factual information in the record was there because 13.124 allows the speaker and the majority leader to completely control the spending of the money. They don't have to submit it for audit.
Council,
that's why it's restricted to limited circumstances, actions that exist and in which the Assembly or Senate has an interest. I'm sorry, Justice.
I see time's up, Chief.
I'd be happy to answer.
A question, but I'll defer to you.
I'd be happy to answer his question.
I'm sure you would, but your time is up, and so I'm going to ask you to go.
Thank you very much for your attention to this very important case.
Counsel, I know you have much you want to probably address. I have a quick question I'm going to throw out to you and let you get to your other points.
That's right.
On your constitutional argument, the Constitution says in Article 8, Section 2, that no money shall be paid out of the Treasury except in pursuance of an appropriation by law. I'm curious how that constitutional provision would affect your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Under 2765, the legislature is given a somewhat sufficient appropriation to carry out its functions. That satisfies the constitutional duty. This court has a somewhat sufficient appropriations under 20.6801. So that obviously, if there were no some sufficient appropriation and there was not money enough to appropriated to carry out constitutional functions, then this court would face a situation like the Flynn case where there would be a constitutional argument that there was not enough money appropriated to carry out constitutional functions. That might be a difficult case, but given that there are some sufficient appropriations for what the legislature does, for what the courts do, for what the governors do, what governor does, that issue is not doesn't need to be resolved.
What's the constitutional function here that's being carried out?
It's the one that Justice Bradley articulated, which is to reapportion the state. That involves, for example, with regard to the Bell Giftos contract, to obtain legal advice as to make sure that your apportionment complies with all statutory and constitutional requirements. And so that is the function that's being carried out. Now, if I may, I do want to correct something that my friend said to Justice Hagedorn, if I may. Justice Hagedorn asked my friend, well, under your interpretation of 1674, how could the legislature function? How could it buy pens and all that? And, you know, this is a question that we tried to ask a couple of times. And what I heard my friend say, well, the legislature can go directly under 2065 because of some sufficient appropriations. Well, that concedes away their case because then that would apply here. But I would also say that is exactly contrary to what my friend told this court on page 21 on his brief, if your honors would turn to that. My friend's discussing our argument that we would prevail just under the some sufficient appropriation statute. And this is what he says, and I'm going to quote it in full. The statute, the some sufficient appropriation statute, is clear on its face. It provides support, i.e. funding for the functions. It does not authorize, italicize, any functions. In order for the legislature to use its some sufficient budget to pay for goods or services furthering its functions, the purchase of those items must be authorized elsewhere. So if my friend is now saying, and has said to this court, that 1674 and 1671 do not provide authorization, and under the logic that he articulated on page 21, then the legislature cannot buy pens, legislature cannot buy power cords, legislature cannot printers. This court cannot buy printers, this court cannot buy computers, this court cannot buy pens. That necessarily follows from his argument, and I think that not only is that argument not grounded in the statutory text, it would ground the functioning of state government to a halt. And I think my friend keeps talking about 13.124. That's certainly what they brought the lawsuit under. I think with respect, they weren't aware of 1674. And what happened was they were, I think with respect, attempted to hobble the legislature during a critical period of its redistricting. And now they've bitten off a little more than they can chew.
Counsel, you look to 16.74 as not just buying pens and papers and pencils, but as that statute gives the authority for the legislature to hire counsel. I mean, it's
to obtain any professional services,
counsel
or otherwise.
Well, here we're talking about hiring counsel.
That's right.
The statute 16.74 is denominated a legislative and judicial, and I see it in large part as a procurement and reimbursement statute, and that's why I asked you before. It seems like an odd place to vest a authority pronouncement of the legislature. But, you know, I look to the judiciary. Are you saying that that's where we, justices, get authority to hire legal counsel? And if we didn't get it from there, we wouldn't have the authority? Is that what you're suggesting?
Your Honor, if your Honors need a statutory authority, that is your authority. If your Honors did not have that, then you would go directly under your constitutional authority. And then you'd have the some sufficient appropriation. And we have explained here that we have a constitutional argument here. But we Honors would not need to go under the constitutional authority because the legislature has authorized your Honors to hire to obtain any professional.
So this is our authority for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Without this statutory authority, then we just have to rely on, it's our constitutional authority that allows us to enter into contracts?
That's right.
Whoa, that's a big use of a hammer for entering into some kind of small contract.
Your Honor, it's not a hammer. The legislature has provided all three branches.
equal power to enter in professional services contracts under 1671 for the executive branch, 1674 for the judicial branch, and for itself. And of course, if that wasn't there, I do think that it is important for all three of those branches to be able to get professional services, including legal services, to complete their functions, which is why then the backdrop would be the constitutional argument. I see my red light is on.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for very good legal arguments. And it was nice to see all of you today, so thank you for coming into court. We will meet in closed conference at 1 o'clock.